When it comes to horror fiction, there is one writer that has reigned supreme for nearly 50 years. That writer is Stephen King. He's probably the reason that so many people, me included, are horror fiends. Ask any fan and they can tell you what King's story was their initiation into his world. King has created whole worlds and mythologies that have become such a part of our culture that even people who don't identify as horror fans recognize some of his creations. Think of the Red Balloon. You don't have to have read it or seen one of the film adaptations to know what that is. One of his greatest creations is a small town about 60 kilometers from Portland, Maine. Castle Rock, Maine, probably not a place you want to live in, but boy, do we sure like to visit. Castle Rock is the setting for so many Stephen King short stories, novellas, and novels. Dustin Thomason, showrunner for the Castle Rock TV series, called it the human center of the King universe. I'm sure we'll have some thoughts about the Castle Rock TV series, but we're going to focus on the books today. So while other towns hold prominent roles in the Kingverse, none come close to the dominance of Castle Rock. Our guest today is probably the biggest Stephen King fan I know. He's done a thorough read-through of his bibliography in 2020. He started the Castle Rock Book Club in 2021. He's also an incredible artist, excellent ghost hunting companion, and seasoned friend of the podcast. Welcome back, Ryan. It's been a while.
Hello. It has been a while. And I feel like I should say the last episode I was on was Hereditary. And Zencaster has remembered my nickname from that episode. I'm the telephone pole.
I love that. It's weird that it remembered your nickname from that.
Yeah, it's very weird, but I'm okay with it.
Awesome. Well, what's been new with you? It's been at least a few months, I think, since the Hereditary episode.
Yeah, still reading. I've gotten into audiobooks lately, which I'm generally not a fan of, but I can do audiobooks if it's a book that I've already read before.
Right.
Because I feel like my listening comprehension isn't as great as my reading comprehension. So, but if I've read it before, so I've been enjoying going back to The Outsider, and now I'm on If It Bleeds, and I'm listening to those while I work on my artwork. So it's been good lately.
Neither of those are set in Castle Rock, but I think one of the stories in If It Bleeds does reference Castle Rock, doesn't it?
It might. I'm only on the first story so far. So hopefully I'll catch that reference and be able to add something to our growing pile of Castle Rock lore. But no, The Outsider takes place mainly in, I think it's Oklahoma in the book, and then Ohio.
So let's talk a little bit about Stephen King before we dive into Castle Rock. What was your first Stephen King novel or story?
It's a little hard to say. Well, I know what the first one I read in completion was The Mist. And I guess that's technically a novella, but I think I was 12 when I read it. So it was like the perfect length, the perfect type of story.
That would have fucked me up when I was 12.
It's a good one. But I mean, I was raised on horror. There was never a point in my life where I wasn't allowed to watch certain things. Right. So I was already familiar with Stephen King, just in terms of like, because I'd seen Pet Sematary, I think I had already seen Cujo at that point, and the It miniseries from the 90s. So that was the first one that I read in full.
Nice.
And I loved it.
And do you still love it? You've read through, like you did, like I said, in 2020, you reread everything Stephen King.
Yeah, I think that actually started in like 2018, which is when I got really into Stephen King, and I read like just a few, and then I read maybe about probably 20 more in 2019, and then 2020 is when it was like the vast majority I read. But yes, I still love The Mist. I read it, I think the last time I read it was in 2019, and it still holds up. It's like a solid little story, and I love the movie adaptation as well.
I was going to say, the movie adaptation is probably one of my favorite adaptations of a King story.
Yeah, it's great. That's Frank Darabont, right?
And yeah.
Who also did the Shawshank Redemption?
Yes.
The Green Mile?
Yeah, he seems to have a really good understanding of like kind of what King's trying to say, even though he changes some things, which we know, particularly The Mist has a much bleaker ending in the movie than I would say the book does. But we won't give anything away. And what is your favorite?
Gerald's Game, hands down.
You didn't even have to think about it.
No, not at all. Because that was one of the earlier ones that I read back in 2018 when I was like first getting into his work. Mm. And that was the book that made me think like, oh, Stephen King isn't just, these aren't just like all horror fun novels. Like this is a masterpiece. So, mm-hmm. And this year after reading everything that he's published, I went back and I reread Gerald's Game and it's still number one. Like nothing has topped it. It's just it's a perfect book.
I remember you were shocked when you were sharing your ranking of Stephen King novels. I think it was just the novels. I don't think you did the short stories. And I was like, oh, I've never read Gerald's Game. And you were like appalled.
It just hit on everything that I wanted it to hit on. It has like the classic survival horror, like I am going to die if I don't get out of this situation. Mm-hmm. It has really great cathartic psychological horror. And then because Stephen King loves to do that, he loves to throw in these outsiders, as he likes to say. Mm-hmm. There's like this, what the fuck, maybe there is something else here that should not be here on top of it. And it's just, I remember the first time I read that book, lying in bed at night, reading it before bed. And I get to this one scene that I won't say because I don't want to spoil how perfect it is, but, mm-hmm. And it just like made me so scared of the room I was in.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
I will say that I have now read it, as you know, and I loved it. Like it is, like you said, it is, it's got everything. It's got so many different types of horror in it because it's got, like you said, the psychological horror. It's got survival mm-hmm. horror. It's gory in parts. And there's that sense of like, is this really happening or is this all in her head because you're scared and you're in this situation that you are completely out of control. Like you don't have any control in this situation.
Yeah.
Is your mind playing tricks on you? Are you thinking that things are happening that aren't really happening? And it's mm-hmm. incredible.
And I will say Stephen King is always so good with characters and mm-hmm. giving us characters that feel like real people. But I think Jesse in Gerald's Game is the most fleshed out character, like, that he's ever written. I think that you really feel like you get to know on such a deep level until maybe Holly Gibney comes in, but that Holly's character is spread across like five books. Yeah. Whereas we spend just this one novel with Jesse and it's so intimate.
And it's gotta be hard as a writer to write a book pretty much with only one character. Like there are other characters in it, but for the most part, your focus is on one character through the whole book. Mm-hmm. And it never, like your attention never lags. Like I never felt the part where I'm like, oh my God, I'm sick of hearing about Jessie. Let's like, you know, have her interact with somebody else. Or, and I think there's a very clever way that he does it that I don't want to talk about, but.
Yeah, he nails it.
He does. He really does. I should actually go back and answer. So my first Stephen King book was Salem's Lot.
That's such a good one to start on.
It's such a good one to start on because as a preteen teenager, I was 100% enamored with vampires. They were my monster of choice. And so Salem's Lot was everything that I wanted. And it's still, like you said, about the mist still holding up. I think Salem's Lot still holds up. And I need to do a reread this year. Oh, and I can't do it this year. I'm going to run out of time. 2022.
I think I reread Salem's Lot this year, if I remember correctly. And I'm glad you brought it up because Salem's Lot is one of his early books, of course, but it's also the mm-hmm. first one where he really in earnest dives into this kind of the whole theme of examining society on the smaller scale of like a small rural town.
Yeah.
And Stephen King has said that Castle Rock is essentially just Salem's Lot, just without the vampires so that everyone can be alive and interacting.
It's also still one of my favorites. I also love Needful Things.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that a little bit. So what do you think it is that draws you to Stephen King?
Like I said, he's so good with characters and creating not just characters, but worlds that feel real. Mm-hmm. And I've always been one of those readers who I tend to read a little fast. or it's not even so much that I read fast. It's just that when I get really into a book, I don't want to do anything else except read. So I can usually kind of get through them in a couple days. And I think Stephen King is just that kind of writer. Like, he's not really a writer. He's a storyteller. So mm-hmm. when he starts writing, it's very easy for me to forget that I'm reading and just be in that world and be with those people. And he just has a knack for that in a way that few authors really do. Because there are some writers that I like, but it's like they don't want you to forget that you're reading, because they're mm-hmm. they're being prosy or pretty. and that's something me and one of my author friends, Tyler Jones, talk about a lot, is you have to know when to stop trying to sound pretty and just tell the story that you want to tell. Mm-hmm. And Stephen King he's a natural at that.
And I know some people hate how wordy he can be. Like, if you look at some like books like The Stand or It or even The Shining, they are like dense. I mean, he probably has more incredibly thick books than almost anyone else. But for me, like, for the most part, I never feel like I'm reading a very long book.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's one of those things that people latch onto. And I won't say King is without his faults, of course. I'm not just like mm-hmm. he can do no wrong type of fanboy, because I've read some real stinkers by him. But I think it's one of those things that people just latch onto, where it kind of became this thing like, oh, he's very wordy. He describes a lot. And then people are like, yeah, yeah, he describes a lot. And then they go read his books and they're like, okay, I'm looking for too much description. So that's what I'm going to mm-hmm. find. And right. I have read a couple, like we just read The Dark Half for the book club. And I did feel like that one could have been a little bit shorter. Mm-hmm. But generally it's like, you know, even his 600 page books feel like 300.
Yeah, they do. I also love that he can do so many different things. Like, he doesn't just stick to the same kind of horror. And like, there are a lot of his stories that you wouldn't even necessarily classify as horror, but I shouldn't say no matter what, because I agree with you. Like, he has his faults, and there are books that I don't love as much as others. And there are books that I would probably never reread again, unless I was like going to do what you did and reread all of them. But I think overall, like, he can do, you know, sci-fi horror. He can do supernatural horror. He can do the psychological horror. I mean, he can just do so many different things that it keeps you engaged, because you're like, oh, what's this one going to be about? I mean, his last two that he wrote, Billy Summers and Later, right. I wouldn't classify either of them as horror.
He writes so much horror, and that's what he's known for. But I think to him, he doesn't really feel like that label sticks to him in any way. Well, I mean, he knows it does, but he doesn't feel tied or bound by that label, because the story is first and everything else is incidental.
All right. So you started the Castle Rock Book Club. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we are a very small group of people. Well, I think we have about 100 or so members right now.
128.
Oh, 128. Wow. It's grown. Not all of them are reading along, but I'm very happy with the ones that are. So basically, I started this book club because as soon as I finished reading all of Stephen King's books back in January, I wanted to read them again. I just can't get enough. So I started rereading some of my favorites, and then I decided, like, hey, I've read all the Castle Rock books, but I read them so out of order, and it's really just a way to get closer to his work and to just kind of just really immerse myself in it even more and understand it better. So yeah, we're reading in order all the books and short stories that take place in Castle Rock. Now, we're not reading every single book that mentions Castle Rock, because that would be too many books for just like a little Easter egg thrown in there. So we're really reading the ones that take place in or are very adjacent to, with overlapping characters. And it's so fun. I mean, I'm gaining more understanding than I had on my first read through. There's things that I didn't even notice, like, oh, this takes place in the same spot where this other thing happens years mm-hmm. later.
It's interesting too, to read the comments, because there's a Facebook group, the comments that people will put on the threads for each book or each section of the book that we're reading, they'll have me thinking. I'll be like, oh, I never thought about that. Like, I really like that perspective. It definitely helps me read things in a different way. And I'm excited because there's a lot that I haven't actually read. So
for sure. It's really just interesting to see that Stephen King decided to explore like larger themes about, like I said earlier, societies as a whole, just kind of really scaled down into this small town. And then, of mm-hmm. course, incidentally, because he is a horror writer and lover of the supernatural, it turns out that the more we read, the more I realize, like, Castle Rock is, it's a weird, it's a really fucked up place to live.
Yeah. Why does anybody still live there?
Because the cool thing is that, like, the town thrives on it, I think, mm-hmm. because as we'll find out in future books, you know, small towns, they like to gossip. They like to talk about each other and keep each other informed on what so-and-so neighbor is up to. And that's the really cool thing that keeps popping up is, you know, now that we've read Cujo, we're going to be seeing in other books, it's like, oh yeah, that's out by where Joe Camber's dog went crazy a few years back and killed all those people. Mm-hmm. And it's just that small town thing of like, unless you're really narrowing in and focusing on all these stories like we're doing, you might not notice how everything is connected and just how mm-hmm. dark it is, but it really is such a cool town where I think Stephen King has kind of implied that some darker forces might be naturally drawn to it for mm-hmm. whatever reason.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think there are two other towns that come to mind when you actually, I would say there's three. There are three towns that come to mind when I think of Stephen King other than Castle Rock. So there's Derry, Jerusalem's mm-hmm. Lot, and Sidewinder.
Mm, yeah.
And I don't think any of them have nearly as many, I know they don't have as many stories or references to those towns in any of his other books.
Yeah. And it's the same thing as Castle Rock. There might be an odd mention here or there, like, oh, we passed through Sidewinder on our way to blah, blah, blah. But yeah, Castle Rock is really where he decided to put his lore down. And I think it didn't necessarily happen super intentionally because he wanted a place that he could return to.
Right.
But I don't think he really examined it on the level that we are, or me specifically, because I'm working on the timeline and I'm taking all these notes and I'm like, well, if this happened then this means that this had to have happened between the years 68 and 69. But I don't think Stephen King is really taking it that seriously. He's like, oh yeah, I want to say this. I want to tell this story that has this particular theme about society. So I'm going to just plop it in Castle Rock and let all these established characters kind of interact and react to it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it kind of makes sense that he sets it in a small town in Maine because he spent a lot of his childhood in the small town of Durham, which I think has an even smaller population than the fictional population of Castle Rock. So Castle Rock itself, the population ranges anywhere from about 1200 to 1500, depending on what story you're reading. And I thought it was interesting because the name of the town is from a fort in William Golding's novel, Lord of the Flies.
That's right. Yeah. And there's so many locations nearby because you got Castle Hill where cars careen down, and then there's Castle View where some of the more rural townsfolk live, and then of course there's Castle Lake where some of the wealthier summer residents have their houses and come to visit.
Yeah, it's like a whole county.
And just by reading, and these aren't even notes that I've taken, just by reading all these books in order, you kind of learn the geographies like that. And then also, well, I know it's near Harlow. And it's west of Chamberlain, which is the town that Carrie burned down.
Yep.
And there's lots of woodlands in between and just these little things that you pick up that make it feel so real.
Mm-hmm. I actually read a really interesting article today called Why Stephen King's Novels Still Resonate in The Economist. And it was by somebody named KSC. Apparently they go by initials. They referred to Stephen King's like Castle Rock and Derry novels as creepy hall of mirror distortions of the idealized small towns of the American imagination. And I was like, that's a really good description of it.
That's good. That's really good.
So Castle Rock, we're going to talk about the books that we've read and what we're going to read. But I just wanted to bring, so it's referenced in and not like just like a passing reference, like something happened in Castle Rock. That's all. There are no overlapping characters or anything. It's mentioned in Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, Pet Sematary, It, The Stand, Gerald's Game, The Man in the Black Suit, The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, Riding the Bullet, Dreamcatcher, Lisi's Story, N, Under the Dome, A Good Marriage, 112263, Dr. Sleep, Revival, Squad D, and Mr. Harrigan's Phone. That's a lot.
It is. Yeah. And I know that I'm, because even, you know, when we're done reading all these books for the book club, I'm going to be reading more Stephen King. And mm-hmm. I'm always going to have my eye peeled now for those little mentions of Castle Rock. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of them will be like completely unimportant. It'll just be in reference to a story we've already read. But, you know, if I know for a fact that if some character in some unrelated book is like, oh, yeah, I drove through that little town a couple months ago, then I'm going to be like, okay, so this book came out in 2017, so it probably takes place in 2016. And what months of the year?
So speaking of which, you did a whole timeline.
I did a timeline.
So, okay, how long did that take you, first of all? And it's only up to where we've read so far, correct?
Yeah, so it's not finished. It's only up to the dark half. And it really didn't take too long. I spent, I lost a day on it. Because I got up one morning and I was like, oh yeah, I think I'm going to work on this for a while because it just sounds like a fun thing to do. And then like before I knew it, it was like 3 p.m. and I had like not eaten and I was surrounded by all these Stephen King books and I was like flipping back and forth through them. But it's so fun. It's like being an investigator because I've learned so many little details. And I've caught a few little continuity errors, but only mm-hmm. a few. But yeah, so many little things that I just never caught before. And I know for a fact that there's more because I started this timeline after we'd already read a handful of books and I couldn't read them all again. Mm-hmm. But I did comb through them and glean as much as I could.
And now I think, you know, you are so talented as an artist. You should 100% do a map.
I think I'm going to have to do a map. Because there's so much geography.
Yeah. And then like just even thinking like where this happened and, you know, in conjunction with this. And I think that would be really cool.
Yeah. I think when we get to Needful Things, we are going to talk about geography a lot more. Because mm-hmm. Some of the books that we've read, Castle Rock is like the backdrop. But Stephen King intended Needful Things to be kind of like the big showdown, the big finale for Castle Rock and kind of closing right. The book on that, even though we know he didn't because he returns to Castle Rock later. But that is like, it's a book about that town in a way mm-hmm. that none of the other books are. Yeah. So we're going to get to know a lot more people and see so much more geography of the town.
I'm so excited to reread Castle Rock, to reread Needful Things. So let's talk about what we've read so far. And listeners, I will warn you that for these books, there are going to be spoilers. So if you have not read these books, you might want to tune out. Or, I mean, if you're okay with spoilers like me, one of my friends makes fun of me because I am completely like, no, I don't care about spoilers. Tell me. Sometimes I don't want them. Generally, I'm okay with them. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you said, so they're in order. So they're not in like order of the time that they came out, right? Or are they in order?
No, they're in publication order that we've right. read. But yeah, I noticed this while we were kind of reading through the short stories from Skeleton Crew. They're not in chronological order.
Right.
Not always, but generally the main novels are generally.
All right. So the very first Castle Rock novel is The Dead Zone. So did you just take a deep breath?
No.
I'm going to talk about The Dead Zone.
I mean, yeah, I don't love The Dead Zone.
Brief synopsis. Johnny Smith is in a coma after a bad car accident, and he wakes up after almost 5 years. He's gifted, maybe cursed, with a precognitive/clairvoyant ability. So that's kind of a very basic synopsis of The Dead Zone. So you're not a big fan. Why are you not a big fan of The Dead Zone?
I think for me, the story's fine, and I liked it more on my second read through for the book club, but, I think there's some structural problems with it where it feels like the ideas for three different novels kind of wrapped up into one in mm-hmm. a way. So every time I read it, it feels longer than it is, but it is enjoyable, and I like Johnny Smith as a character, so. I don't hate it. It's just not my favorite.
Yeah. Like you said, it's separated into three parts. So there's like the part leading up to the car accident, then like kind of the recovery after the car accident. Is that what you would consider the one part?
Yeah, the whole, I basically consider it like the Johnny and Sarah love story. And then we have the Castle Rock B plot, and then the Greg Stilson A plot, I guess it becomes. And they're all like very different phases in Johnny's life, because it's pre-accident, immediate aftermath of his accident, and then kind of the recovery stage where he's kind of moved on with his life.
Right. Yeah. See, I get it. I feel like for me, I get a lot of people feel it's disjointed. I like that it feels like here he is kind of normal, kind of living a normal life. Something terrible happens to him. He starts to use his gift to help deal with something. I don't want to say relatively minor, because a serial killer is not relatively minor, but in the grand scheme of, you know, the world compared to the Greg Stilson storyline, he has to amp up to that. And that's something even bigger. So I kind of like it like that. To me is kind of like a through line, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the thing that I always go back to, it's just Stephen King has changed so much. Like his fiction now is, I still love it. Because, like I said, I just reread The Outsider. It's one of my favorite books ever. But I feel like if Stephen King had the idea for The Dead Zone now, it would probably be like three, like the Mr. Mercedes trilogy, I think.
Oh, yeah. I could see that. That makes sense.
Yeah. This is the first book that Castle Rock pops up in. And we're all really only there for a couple chapters. Mm-hmm. But we meet some iconic characters that are going to be established lore for like all of the Castle Rock books going forward.
Frank Dodd and George Bannerman.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. All right, let's talk about Frank Dodd a little bit.
Yeah, what about him?
So he is a police officer.
Well, do you want me to do this the really sad way where I know way too much information?
Yes,
do Franklin it. Dodd is born in 1950 to Henrietta and Billy Dodd. Let's see. I'm scrolling through my timeline here. I have so much useless information. Okay. November 12th, 1970, when Frank Dodd is 20 years old, he murders Alma Frechette, a waitress at the Coffee Pot in the town common, which is basically the town park of Castle Rock. In 1971, July, he officially joins the police force, taking on, you know, kind of more administrative duties. He commits five murders between 1970 and 1975 when he is apprehended. And I won't go into the details of all of those. You'll just have to read the book. he is very close to the sheriff of Castle County, George Bannerman, who is kind of a big character. In the early years of Castle Rock.
Did this book come out in the 70s or was it the early 80s? Was it 81?
In the 70s, I think.
70s, okay. So I'm sure in the 70s, the idea of a cop as a serial killer was shocking.
He just seemed like a kind of an incel.
He does seem like an incel. So George Bannerman and Frank Dodd both come into play in Cujo, George Bannerman in a bigger way than Frank Dodd. There's just kind of a little reference to him.
Yeah. So, and I have to say, because I read Cujo before The Dead Zone, and the first page of Cujo spoils the Dead Zone in a really big way.
Oh, yes, it does.
So when I started reading Cujo, I was like, oh, I think this is related to another book of his. And then when I got to the Dead Zone, I was like, well, I know who the serial killer is because I read Cujo recently.
Oh, and we talked about this. And Cujo was a book that I hated the first time I read it. I absolutely hated it. It took me forever to read. And while I'm not quite as fast a reader as you are, I used to be much faster. But I it took me forever to read it, like weeks to read it the first time I read it, which was very unusual for me. And I think I even put it down for a while and then had to come back to it. And I think I said to you when you were talking about starting this book club, I'm like, I don't know if I want to reread Cujo.
It's so good though.
And yeah, the second time I read it, I actually really enjoyed it. I got a lot more out of it. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's a heartbreaking story.
It is. And that's the thing about Stephen King. Every time I bring up Cujo, and this actually makes me a little bit mad, people love to point out, oh, he doesn't remember writing that book. yeah, he was on drugs. He doesn't remember writing it. And it's like, yeah, but he was lucid when he wrote it, even if he doesn't remember it after the fact. Because yeah. Cujo is not just a story about an evil dog. In the same way that Christine is not just a book about an evil car that comes to life. Like, Cujo has so many layers, and there's just so much there to dissect. Mm-hmm. And I even thought, like, when I was rereading it, I was like, am I giving him a little too much credit here, or is it really amazing? And people are like, no, it's all on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the dichotomy between the Trentons and the Cambers and what their lives are like, how they interact with each other. Like, it's so good.
Mm-hmm. And even if I get the sense that Stephen King may have fluffed in a little bit here and there just to make it novel length and not novella territory.
Right.
But even so, I loved all the sequences, especially with Charity Camber and her son Brett. And Cujo is Brett's dog. And I just loved all their moments together. And it's such a good, good story.
Yeah. And we've talked before about how some novels really make you feel like you're there. Like we talked about this in The Elementals and how you feel the heat and the humidity. Yeah. And I felt that with Cujo. You feel how hot it is when, oh my gosh, I can't think of her name. What's the Donna. Mom's name? Donna. When Donna and Tad are in the car.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is this family member, really, Cujo is a family member, turning evil, not really evil, turning bad because of something that was beyond his control. And so George Bannerman, how does George Bannerman fit into Cujo?
Well, and I just have to share this little fun fact. Okay, I'll answer your question first. George Bannerman shows up on the scene at the end of the book and just gets shredded by Cujo. He is like the sheriff of Castle County that was such a prominent role in the Dead Zone. And then he just gets destroyed immediately.
Yeah, and you think he's going to like come to the rescue. You think he's there to save them. No.
He's just done. And the little thing that I've noticed with this timeline, there's a big error that Stephen King has made here, because we know for a fact that Frank Dodd was apprehended and committed suicide on December 17th, 1975. Like, we know that. That's not in question. We know he was a 25-year-old dude, I think, born in 1950. And then we also know that George Bannerman is killed by Cujo in 1980. We know this because the very first page of the book says, in the summer of 1980, evil returns to Castle Rock in the form of Cujo.
Yeah.
Yet in the dark half, which we're reading right now, Stephen King says, George Bannerman found out that his favorite deputy was a serial killer and then 2 years later was killed by a dog. And I'm no, it's not true. It's just not true. And I had to get that out because it's been bothering me for a while.
Since you discovered it? That's fair.
Yeah.
And Frank Dodd, so we talked about how it gives away that Frank Dodd right away in the first chapter, that Frank Dodd was the serial killer. And he's kind of the intimation that maybe there's something more than just an unfortunate rabies infection that's causing what's happening.
Yeah. So when George is being mauled, he has time to think. He looks at Cujo and he has time to think something along the lines of, well, Frank, is that you? Are you, you couldn't get enough of evil or whatever? Mm-hmm. And I choose not to take that literally because I don't think Stephen King is implying that Frank Dodd has possessed Cujo or anything like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it just speaks more along the lines of evil as maybe some sort of like supernatural Final Destination-esque force. Mm-hmm. is drawn to Castle Rock and bad things, because it does say at the end of the book, Cujo, and it makes me cry every time, line, you know, Cujo tried his best to be a good boy and he couldn't help it.
Yeah. That's actually my synopsis of Cujo is a good boy gets rabies and wreaks havoc during a few hot, hot days.
He couldn't help it. And he wasn't possessed. It.
And that's, I think, yeah. Cause they talk about like, Tad thinks something's in his closet. There's a monster in his closet. And
yes, there is an element in the book that makes me believe that the Trentons might have a little bit of shine to them.
Yeah.
Because some of the things that happen in that closet cannot be explained by, oh, it's just a coat shaped funny over a chair. And then, of course, Vic, the dad, when he's out of town, has these like very powerful convictions that there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. I would lean more towards the, it's just the nature of Castle Rock. Like there's something going on in maybe like a Dark Tower universe kind of way.
Let's talk about The Body, which is a novella from different seasons. And it is basically about four friends who go on a hike to find a dead body.
On September the 2nd, 1960.
This is the story that the movie Stand By Me is based on, which I love Stand By Me. It's probably one of my favorite coming of age movies. And it makes sense. Like it also came out when I was about the same age as Gordy LaChance. And his friends. So mm-hmm. It just speaks to me. But The Body, I wasn't a huge fan of. And I thought I would, because I've read it before and I really don't remember disliking it. Not that I disliked it. I just found parts of it really hard to just plow through.
Yeah. The thing that I noticed, because Different Seasons is such an amazing collection overall, but I noticed that The Body did not have a lot of reread value, I guess. It was a slog, and there were even other people in the book club who were like, it's just really hard to get through this, this year. Yeah, I kind of agree.
I agree.
And I'm not a big fan of the coming of age genre anyway, so it's never really been my favorite.
Right. But we do have a lot of people that, a lot of characters that show up. A lot? Would I say a lot?
A few key ones. Yeah. George Bannerman does get a mention, even though back in 1960, he is Castle Rock's town constable and not yet the sheriff.
Right. And we have Ace Merrill.
Yep. This is the introduction to Ace, right?
It is the introduction to Ace. Yeah.
Yeah. So John Ace Merrill, who pops up in quite a few stories.
The one thing I do like about The Body is that I think it is very, it is tied to this realization, and everybody comes to it when you are when you're kind of on that cusp of childhood / teenage years where you start to realize that like life is finite. Like you don't have an eternity in front of you. And so it's just kind of all about coming to terms with that and growing up and realizing that the things that you cherish as a child are not necessarily going to be the things that you cherish. I shouldn't say that you cherish. They're not necessarily going to be things that are with you.
Yeah.
Throughout your life. And it's very, like, it is sad that way.
Yeah. And the thing, I just don't like it because, and I thought this was just a cliche blown out of proportion until I reread it again. The most poignant moment that Gordy remembers from that whole period is looking at a deer in the morning. And I'm like, sometimes a deer is just a deer in the woods. I mean, they were in the woods. You would be bound to see one sooner or later. But he's like, it was the most profound moment of my whole childhood life. And I was like, your brother died a few months ago, dude. That's just a deer.
I think that's the thing that differentiates the book from the movie, too, is that in the book, Gordy and his brother aren't really close. But in the movie, they're shown to be much closer than they are in the book.
I don't remember the movie much at all. I've only seen it once. Well, they moved Castle Rock to Oregon in the movie.
The next story that we read was Uncle Otto's Truck in Skeleton Crew. So the next three stories are all taken from Skeleton Crew. So this is a good old-fashioned revenge story involving an eccentric uncle, business partners, and a malevolent truck.
Yeah, shades of Christine popping up. Mm-hmm. Skeleton Crew is where it gets really messy with the timeline because not only, of course, some things aren't always specifically dated, but it's also that, like, I think Stephen King messes up sometimes because it's just a short story and it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. But so this one, it takes place before 1960, so before The Body. And of course, the story takes place over a number of years, but Uncle Otto officially murders his business partner in 1955.
And then he becomes fixated on the idea that the truck is going to kill him.
Not a lot of overlap here in terms of like the grand Castle Rock lore, but I think I said this in the book club too. It's just, it's interesting to have these odd little characters just kind of on the fringes of the town that even if they never come back again, it's just interesting to know that this story played out on this little back road.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to small towns and how they build their own mythology too, right? Like when you, like I think about my brother lives in a small town in British Columbia. And he was telling me this story about a local who has a pet grizzly bear. And I'm like, does this guy really have a pet grizzly bear, or is this local legend? Like, and it's just, it's kind of interesting the way that people, you know, small towns in particular, because you know pretty much everyone and you know all the weird little things that they do, certain things become bigger than they actually are. And I just, I like that idea. And I think that's the one thing that Castle Rock does, that happens in Castle Rock a lot, is you hear all these kind of like rumors and innuendo about people. And there's even like scenes like in Grandma, where, which we'll talk about in a minute, where George, the protagonist, picks up the phone and he hears people gossiping on the other end.
Yeah, exactly. There's, and that will come back in Needful Things a lot. Just like the whole idea of town gossip.
Yes.
It's, again, it's a good way to just on a very micro level, just talk about like culture as a whole, how, because towns have like their own little celebrities, because it's like, ooh, I heard that she, that her baby died and she abandoned it or something. And then it's like, this person becomes a town celebrity. And then it kind of echoes how the media kind of gossips about celebrities in a way, like, ooh, Kim Kardashian got a new sink in her bathroom. And it's like that kind of thing.
Exactly. But on a like more micro level, I like that. So the next story is Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, which I love this story.
It's so good.
It's so good. And it's got just enough creep in it, but overall it's not scary.
It reminded me of The Mist.
Oh, okay.
It just like in a weird way, because the theory behind The Mist, right, is that like some sort of other dimension has kind of bled through into Maine. And it seems like Mrs. Todd, Ophelia Todd, was kind of like jumping in and out of that in a weird way.
Right.
But it's very good. And mostly it's like, it's a sweet story, I think.
It is. So Homer, a caretaker, tells his, they're sitting on like I always think, and I don't even know if this actually is in the book, but I always think of them sitting on like a porch on like a rocking chair telling these stories. Maybe that's not what's happening.
I think they're sitting outside like a service station or gas station.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. You're right. And he tells his friend the story of Mrs. Todd and her obsession with finding the shortest route anywhere. And you see like he kind of falls in love with her through the course of the story. And and so her shortcut is into other dimensions.
And she's just trying to find like the fastest route through the back roads of Maine.
Yeah. And I think, again, when we talk about Castle Rock being this area where so many weird things happen, like, of course, there's going to be interdimensional portals that you can just go through.
Yeah. And there's a line that they repeat throughout that story. I wish I had it written down, but the guy telling the story says this a lot, like, sometimes there are holes in places.
Yes.
He says there are holes in the middle of things. And it's like, that's kind of a cool, creepy way to describe how some things in Castle Rock just like find their way to Castle Rock. Mm-hmm. Even if Stephen King didn't intend it, you can just kind of like take that and run with it, I think. And Ophelia Todd went missing in August of 1973, which doesn't matter. But I don't have a role if it's not to point it out. So
I don't have a role. So we're reading The Dark Half right now, and there is a character named Homer in The Dark Half. And for some reason, I was convinced that it was the same Homer. And I had to be like, no, it can't be the same Homer. Mm-hmm. It's not the same Homer, Sherry. Even though he is also a caretaker in Castle Rock.
Because The Dark Half takes place in June of 1988, and the Homer of the short story, Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, he ends up disappearing with her in 1983.
I hope they're living somewhere happy now.
Yeah, they're dead.
They probably are. All right, that leads us to Grandma, which is so creepy.
Yeah, Grandma reminded me, and somebody said this in the book club too, it reminded them of Hereditary, and I felt the same way a couple times.
Yeah. So George, a young boy, left home alone with his bedridden grandma, who turns out to be more than he ever feared. So grandma dies and George is left alone. How old is George? Like 9, 10?
Yeah, I think he's 10.
10. Or like, and
that's not in the timeline.
he's not a teenager yet, that's for sure. So his brother ends up breaking a bone, I think, while he's playing baseball, and his mom has to go and take care of him. And grandma is this creepy, cantankerous old woman who is bedridden. And when she dies, like, I can't even, like, I think about that in terms of being a kid his age and thinking that you're home alone with your grandmother, your dead grandmother, mm-hmm. who turns out to be like a witch.
Yeah. So all these rumors have been circulating about grandma for years about how she always consulted her weird books when she needed luck. And people would say she has a little too much luck.
Yeah. And they talk about how she couldn't have children. And then she resorted to these books. And suddenly she had, I think, like, there's a few children.
Yeah. At least. Several.
And George has overheard a lot of talk about grandma, like saying that his mom is the only one that knows how to deal with her when she's like this. And at first it seems very innocuous. Like, yeah, of course, like, you know, grandma, she's getting older. So maybe the mom can calm her down, but mm-hmm. it's more than that. And it's just so creepy. It's probably one of my favorite short stories that I read by Stephen King, simply because it's just so atmospheric. And for me, I can't even imagine if that happened to me when I was that age.
Yes. And in a way that I think is similar to The Body, it kind of confronts, it's like the theme of children confronting death and realizing how final that is for the first time in their lives. Mm-hmm. Henrietta Dodd pops up in this story.
Yes, she does. Frank Dodd's mom.
Frank Dodd's mother. I think there's an issue here, and we had a little debate about this in the book club, but we know when this takes place because George's mother is described in the story as being just past 50. Right. And then later in the story, we find out definitively that she was born in 1930. So this has to take place at minimum 1980 or 81.
Right.
And when did Frank Dodd kill himself? 1975.
Right.
I find it hard to believe, even though it's plausible, that his mother would just go back to being the town gossip, because as we will learn in Needful Things, Castle Rock is a town that gossips a lot and holds grudges, and they kind of, you know, they put on a big show of that.
Yeah.
It's plausible that Henrietta Dodd survived her possible heart attack after her son killed himself. And it's plausible that she had like a group of friends who believed that she had no idea that her son was a serial killer, which she did.
Yeah.
But I just don't buy it. I think Stephen King just messed up with his dates there.
I mean, but you got to give him some leeway. He's written over 70 books. So
for sure. Stories. Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't fault him because I think it's so fun to find these things.
Yeah, I agree. So here's a little bit of trivia that I thought was really interesting. So this story was adapted into an episode of The Twilight Zone in the 80s.
Ooh.
And some of the voiceovers of Grandma were done by Piper Laurie, who played Margaret White in the first film adaptation of Carrie.
I can see your dirty pillows.
I need to watch that episode of The Twilight Zone now.
Yeah, me too. I want to watch that.
Then we have Nona, also from Skeleton Crew. And this is a man in prison tells the story of the night he met Nona and went on a murderous rampage with her.
And we know that this story takes place between the years 1968 and 1970 because of the return of John Ace Merrill, local
yes.
bad guy.
This man in prison, he's unnamed, right? We never learn his name.
No.
Is he crazy? Or did he actually run in? Because he goes on this murderous rampage, kills a whole bunch of people, and then I think they're in a cemetery, right? And Nona turns into a giant rat?
Yeah. I didn't know what to make of that.
Yeah. I feel like it's a figment of his imagination, but I don't know.
he had a flashback to when he kind of hallucinated that everyone at a school dance turned into rats before he ever met Nona.
Oh, right. Yeah. And
I think the thing is Stephen King is just scared of rats because he writes a lot of scary stories about them.
Maybe.
Who else pops up in that story? It was Vern Tessio, right?
Oh, yeah. Vern does. Yes, that's right.
Yes. Yeah. Vern Tessio, because this is a flashback. Yes. So it was kind of in 1964 to 1966, Vern Tessio spreads the word that this narrator was kind of flirting with Ace Merrill's girlfriend at the time. So Ace Merrill beats the crap out of this guy. And that girlfriend, Betsy Mellenfant, however you pronounce that.
Yeah.
It's probable that she is the sister of a character named Ronnie Mellenfant, who was one of the main characters of Hearts in Atlantis, which is set in 1966.
Does that mean bad baby, Mellenfant? Mellenfant?
It sounds like it. Hey, that would be Binks.
That's going to be his new nickname, Mellenfant. Oh. And now we're on the dark half. So we're about halfway through the dark half.
Mm, I finished it, but yeah, officially we're halfway through.
So this is about Thad Beaumont, a writer who kills off his pseudonym, and the results are, to say the least, catastrophic.
This is the story that introduces Alan Pangborn, who is the sheriff who took over after George Bannerman was killed by Cujo.
Yes, and he comes back up in Needful Things.
Yeah, in a major way. He's pretty much the main character of Needful Things.
King's previous novel before The Dark Half was The Tommyknockers, which was also, like a lot of his previous books, had been written while he was in the height of his addiction. But basically, between the 2 years between The Tommyknockers and The Dark Half, his wife, Tabitha King, staged an intervention and was like, enough is enough. You need to like heal yourself, basically. And I think The Dark Half, I mean, I'm not quite halfway through yet. It really touches on a lot of like what I would imagine would be his personal demons at the time. Like there's, you know, the idea of addiction. There's, you know, your dark half, family issues, concern about his career, because all of these books prior, well, not all of them, but a lot of them had been written while he was addicted. And so, you know, what does his future as a writer look like?
That's interesting. I didn't really think about that much while reading, but it does make a lot of sense. And as much crap as we give the Tommyknockers, that book is in a big way about addiction too, because it's about like these townspeople find this thing that makes them like so efficient and like energized, and they get so much shit done, but they're also acting crazy. And yeah, I guess The Dark Half could be interpreted that way. I was thinking more about Stephen King's own pseudonym.
Yes.
Why am I blanking?
Richard Bachman.
Richard Bachman. Yeah. I almost said Thompson. I was thinking more about his own pseudonym, who I don't know a whole lot about when he decided to give that up, or if he was outed. I don't remember.
But I think he decided to give it up. Hold on. Let me look it up. I think I don't think he was outed like Thad is. Thad and George Stark are, I suppose. Uh-huh. Or actually, I guess they're not outed. They're
threatened.
Forced out. Yeah. But he did do a similar thing where he published an obituary or something for Richard Bachman.
Yeah, that's right.
Saying that he died of cancer of the pseudonym.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I like your line of thinking, how it's about his addiction, because I remembered there's a lot of key moments in the book where Liz, and this isn't a spoiler or anything, but it's like Liz, Thad's wife, would say, I didn't like Thad when he was writing a George Stark book, because he became this different person, and I was scared of him and I did not like him. So when he finally gave him up, I cried from happiness. This is another one of those books like The Dead Zone, where Castle Rock doesn't really feature into it into a big way, and not really at all until the very end. It mainly serves to kind of just introduce Alan Pangborn and prop him up as a big character moving forward.
Yeah. Actually, so it does say that he was outed. So where is it? I lost it. A bookstore clerk noted similarities between the writing styles of King and Bachman, and basically went to the Library of Congress, located publishing records, and found a document that named King as the author of one of Baughman's novels. So then he wrote to King's publishers with the documents that he had uncovered and said, what should I do? So, and this is all from Wikipedia. 2 weeks later, Stephen King telephoned this book clerk, Steve Brown, personally, and said, write an article about it. And at the time, he was working on Misery, which was supposed to be a Baughman book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating, because Misery is such a good book, and it's a book about how Stephen King can be mad at his fans, which mm-hmm. I totally get and respect, because he got so much shit for publishing Eyes of the Dragon,
right?
Which is just a pure fantasy novel.
Yep.
And for the readers to kind of claim ownership and be like, no, you need to write this, you need to get back to this, blah blah blah. That's interesting.
Unlike George Stark and Thad Beaumont, there isn't, I mean, I don't think there's a huge difference in the writing styles between King and Baughman.
Right.
Whereas there's supposed to be a very definitive difference between the way that Thad writes and the way that George Stark writes.
Yeah, totally.
We've talked a lot about toxic fandom and people being like, no, you owe it to me to do this. Ugh, and I know. The fact that that was a thing when Misery came out, and I'm sure before that, but that's the first thing that I can remember ever seeing mm-hmm. kind of that toxic fandom.
Yeah. And the internet has just made it so much worse. I remember back when the new Stand adaptation came out, and I saw somebody petitioning online to get them to release a new version of it, which had been they wanted them to re-edit it so it'd be in chronological order, because the show did a lot of like flashback type things.
Right.
And I hated that show. The Stand was terrible. But I was like, no, you don't have the right to claim that you can change something. Like, you can dislike it all you want. I hated the fucking thing.
Yep.
But it's not my art to change. Exactly. You either like it or you don't. It's so gross. And I don't even watch Game of Thrones, but I remember what Twitter was like when that last season was airing was just mm-hmm. awful.
Oh, yeah. All right. So that's us caught up on, not caught up, but that's where we are right now. Coming up, we have a whole bunch of short stories. One of my favorite Stephen King books. So I'm super excited. What are you most looking forward to rereading before we talk a little bit about what's coming up?
Obviously Needful Things, because that is in my top 10 King books. I love it so much. And I'm also really looking forward to The Sun Dog, because I remember really liking it, mm-hmm. but I don't remember all the details of the story. So I think that's going to be a fun one to go back to. And I know that The Sun Dog is going to introduce a new character, Pop Merrill, who is the grandfather or like the something to Ace Merrill.
Yeah, I feel like he's like, maybe it is his father, maybe?
I'm not sure, but yeah, so we're still not even done being introduced to new characters, which I think is really cool.
So you mentioned The Sun Dog, so that's from Four Past Midnight, and that is a 15-year-old boy. This is the most inane sentence that I could have described this story with, but it was the only one that I could say without giving anything away. So we're not going to give away any spoilers now. The Sun Dog, a 15-year-old boy receives a Polaroid camera for his birthday.
Oh, yeah. Also, clown walks around giving away red balloon. So that's all you need to know.
Exactly. Exactly.
He does get a camera, though.
He does get a camera. So yeah, I'm excited to read The Sun Dog. That is, in fact, we were talking about this before we started recording. Out of all of the things that we are reading next, I've actually only read The Sun Dog, Needful Things, and Bag of Bones. So I'm really excited to read the rest.
You're not missing much. Because okay. I know this is jumping ahead, but I hate those Gwendy books so much. Mm-hmm. I despise them. Richard Chismar, or Kismar, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. So the second Gwendy book he wrote on his own without Stephen King, and I had pre-ordered his book Chasing the Boogeyman, but then I read that second Gwendy book and it was so bad that I canceled my pre-order.
Oh no.
I could.
I've heard really good things about that book though.
Me too, but I'm not falling for it.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Needful Things. Again, no spoilers. So a new shop opens in Castle Rock selling collectibles and antiques, but owner Leland Gaunt accepts a different kind of currency.
Your life. That's not necessarily true.
No.
Yeah, and that reminds me a lot of Salem's Lot, how Barlow and Straker, I almost said Barker and Starlow. Barlow and Straker kind of moved to town and they set up shop, but the shop is just a front for what they really want.
Yeah. So this was supposed to be the last Castle Rock story, but as we mentioned, it does come up again. However, I think this is the one that is.
Yeah. It's the
really
climate.
About Castle Rock.
Yeah. It's the last one that matters, I think. And it's not all spooky. I would say it's hardly spooky, except for maybe in a few scenes. Mm-hmm. It is very satirical, and I think it's like really sharp-witted. And it's just, I remember, it's been a while, but I remember just how well done it was with all, it's like a soap opera. Like you almost need to be kind of like connecting characters' names with pieces of yarn on a board just to keep everything straight, because it's like the premise of the story is that the shop owner is basically turning the town against each other.
You want the serial killer board? That's what you're saying. Like
I think I'm gonna need one by the time we're done.
And then we have It Grows on You from Nightmares and Dreamscapes. Never read it, but I think it's basically about a house where some horrible things happened. And the house, I feel like, starts to grow its own wings or something. Not wings, not like a bird. I feel like, I don't know. I didn't want to read too much of the synopsis since I haven't read it, but.
I've read Nightmares and Dreamscapes, but I'm blanking on that story.
Mm. I have Nightmares and Dreamscapes sitting right next to me, actually, while we're...
It's a good collection.
Time. And then we have two stories from Bazaar of Bad Dreams, Drunken Fireworks, and Premium Harmony.
Yeah, I remember Drunken Fireworks, and it's a very fun story. I just didn't remember... I didn't know that it took place in Castle Rock, so now I'm excited to get back to it.
I think Premium Harmony, based on what I've read... again, didn't read too much because I don't want to spoil anything for myself, despite me saying earlier that I like spoilers. It sounds like just a relationship, as King is very good at doing, writing a relationship between, like, a bad marriage.
Oh, I see.
Which he does very well, which is funny considering he's been married for so many years.
Yeah. But I love, what's the Full Dark No Stars, the collection?
Mm-hmm.
That's such a good collection. And what's the story called? I think it's just called A Good Marriage or A Happy Marriage or something. He's so good at that. Bag of Bones.
Writer Mike Noonan is grieving the loss of his wife at their lake house on Dark Score Lake, which sounds, I love the name Dark Score Lake.
Me too. And we recently, very recently added this to the lineup. It wasn't originally because it takes place in an unincorporated township on Dark Score Lake, but technically it is in Castle County, and I think there is going to be a lot of talk about Castle Rock just kind of peripherally, so we're going to go ahead and read it. I didn't love this book.
No, I really enjoyed it when I read it.
I think by the time I got to it, it had become such a cliche of, like, the grieving protagonist who is a writer and his house. Although I will say, in hindsight, so I read the book, didn't care for it, but then I read about it and how it was so inspired by the Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Yes, yeah.
And I love that book. So kind of like looking at it in that lens of, oh, it's kind of like a gothic novel type lens, that made me kind of view it a little differently. So I'm going to try to go into it this time with that in mind, and hopefully I like it a lot more.
Yeah, I'm interested to reread it because it's definitely one that I've only read once.
Oh, and I don't think we mentioned this, but Gerald's Game also takes place on Dark Score Lake.
Yes, it does.
And I believe one character pops up real quick at the very end. So I'm going to have to scan through Gerald's Game and maybe add that to the timeline.
It also makes me think, and I know you don't like this game, but I love this game. This story makes me think, and it's not very similar, but it makes me think of the video game Alan Wake.
Right.
Who I always think
Stephen King inspired.
so Stephen King inspired because it's about a writer who goes to a lake house with his wife, and she disappears, and then he has to kind of solve the mystery of what happened. So, but it just has kind of a very Stephen King vibe, which I love.
Meow.
Oh my gosh, I know.
They're cute. Oh.
She's upset. So then we have Gwendy's Button Box. So this was the one written with Stephen King?
Yeah, so Stephen King collaborated on the first one and then the third one, which hasn't come out yet, but it will be out by the time our book club gets to it.
Excellent. And you liked the first one?
It was okay, but I'm a long way from loving it.
Okay. Then we have Elevation, which has, now correct me if I'm wrong, does it have shades of Thinner?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So I have not read that, so I'm excited to read that one.
Elevation is kind of a sweet, melancholy story. Mm. I don't understand why it was published independently. I think it would have, presentationally, I think it would have been a lot more of a star if it was like the longest piece in one of his collections. I don't know anything about publishing, but it's a cute story. I just, on its own, it's like, what is this?
And then we have Gwendy's Magic Feather and Gwendy's Final Task. So obviously we can't talk about Gwendy's Final Task. It hasn't come out yet, but Gwendy's Magic Feather.
It takes place years after the first one, I think. So when Gwendy's an adult, and I think she's like a teenager in the first one.
Ah, I see. All right.
And, you know, it's just that thing, and I'm not going to give anything away about it, but it's just that thing where I'm not interested in characters who, A, don't feel real, and B, are just perfect. And that's what Gwendy is, which really sucks. She leads this very, she didn't start off that way, but very quickly into the first book, she leads a very charmed life where things just work for her. And when we get a glimpse into her future, she's successful, she's pretty, everyone just fawns over her all the time. And she's like, oh, I got all this money and don't know what to do with it. And it's like, I'm not interested in that at all. And so it just really, none of the characters in that book are memorable at all.
That's rough, because I think, you know, when you look at Stephen King's characters as a whole, one thing I think you can say about probably pretty much all of them, like the protagonists, I mean, is that nobody's perfect. They all have like some pretty significant flaws.
Uh-huh.
None of them live a charmed life.
Yeah, they do. As Stephen King's career is so successful, he does write a lot of characters who are like, oh, I'm so wealthy from these books that I did.
Yes.
But at the same time, they do feel like real people.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, the fact that they have a lot of money is, if anything, just a device to give them the freedom to experience whatever story he's telling. It's not like...
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's not as if they're like traveling the world and, you know, buying all these things. Like most of his characters are really humble. And I think Stephen King is really humble about everything and really down to earth considering his success.
Yeah.
Like he could be like some authors we know who just are so blinded by their charmed life that they lead now, and they're really privileged and they don't feel like they ever have to change, and they just double down on really shitty things, but and hate trans people. But Stephen King is not perfect. Like I've said, he's not like, you know, he stumbles over himself sometimes, and I don't follow him. I don't follow celebrities on Twitter at all. But I unfollowed Stephen King just because sometimes it's like, you didn't have to say it that way.
Right.
But I think he's well-meaning and he's pretty humble.
He's not unproblematic. Like he has some, particularly in his earlier books, like he uses language and things that wouldn't fly today. But he definitely is willing to admit when he's made mistakes. Like he's owned up to some of his mistakes that he's done, and he's, you know, tried to change, unlike certain people, like you talked about, that seem to live in a magical world where they don't have to change and don't have to adapt or accept that they've made mistakes.
And I've noticed on my rereads too, it's like for the most part, when he writes something really questionable, it's because he's so good at getting into character's head. It's like, you know, the writing is this way because this is how that character thinks. Like we made a lot of jokes about how in Salem's Lot he refers to a woman's breast as a delectable set of Jehoobies. But it's like, and that got really popular on Reddit when it's like, oh, Stephen King is at it again. But it's like, if you zoom out, that sequence happened when he was writing through the lens of a really sleazy character who we're not supposed to like.
That's true. That's a very good point. All right, let's touch a little bit on Castle Rock adaptations, because there have been a fair amount of movies made of some of these stories that we've talked about. And there's obviously the Castle Rock TV series, which has almost nothing to do with what we're talking about.
No, it's not canon at all. No. Annie Wilkes fighting vampires? Are you kidding me?
Are there any adaptations that you really love that stand out for you?
I don't hate Cujo. It has nothing on the book, of course. Mm-hmm. It loses a lot of those intricate layers we were talking about and kind of the depth of the story, and it does become more just about this dog that's killing a bunch of people. Yeah. But it's a fun watch and I don't hate it. And I remember Vic is a DILF, right?
Yeah, he is.
He's so tight. And you can tell that the filmmakers were like, we need to film this again, but you have to have your shirt off. So there's like so many random scenes where he's just shirtless. Mm-hmm. It's like, I get it. Donna, why did you cheat on Vic? He's so fucking hot.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good one. I've actually not seen, I've seen The Body. I'm looking at our list right now. I have never seen, besides Cujo and The Body, Stand By Me, I've never seen a single adaptation. Because I don't watch movies as much as I used to.
Right.
This is going to sound pretentious, but I'm not meaning it that way. When I rarely watch movies now, so when I do watch one, I tend to rewatch something that I love because I know I love it, or it's like, right, I'm going to watch something that I'm pretty sure is going to be good. And a lot of his adaptations just aren't the greatest.
I've seen The Dead Zone like years ago, so I couldn't speak confidently on it, but I remember liking it. Cujo, I enjoy quite a lot because I think, like you said, it doesn't have anything on the book, but again, you really get that feeling of like how hot and sticky the weather is. And, mm-hmm. you know, Cujo is so ferocious and Dee Wallace is amazing in anything she's in. So
oh, yeah.
I'm always a big fan of anything that I see her in. And Stand By Me is my favorite. Stand By Me, like I said, it has a very nostalgic vibe to me because I remember watching that at slumber parties and with friends, and we were about the same age and we all had crushes on Corey Feldman and Will Wheaton.
Oh.
And River Phoenix, like they're like the four of them are just so incredible. And it's got John Cusack, it's got Kiefer Sutherland. Like it is everything that little 80s year old, oh my gosh. Little 80s Sherry would have been like absolutely in love with. So
I love that Kiefer.
I mean, I did. I loved Kiefer Sutherland. So even though he's so bad, and he was such a bad boy in the 80s, like all his movies, he was bad.
It's part of the charm.
100%. So I really want to see The Dark Half, but I'm going to obviously wait until after I finish it. I want to watch that Twilight Zone episode of Grandma.
Yeah, I do want to see that.
All right, so what's next? So after we finish the Castle Rock books, are we going to go on to something else? Like what's the – do you have an idea?
I don't. I've kind of floated out a couple just random ideas, nothing I'm committed to. Like we could do the Dark Tower books after this, and we can talk about all those little side books that kind of connect to the Dark Tower universe, or something I would love. We could read all the books that Holly Gibney is in because she's amazing. Yes. Or we could just – at the beginning of every month, we can just vote. Like, what do we want to read this month? I'm down for anything, but it's just such a good, it's a good little group because it's a good way to stay connected to Stephen King's work and to really just dive in depth into mm-hmm. it, which I could be doing by myself, but that's not nearly as fun. And my fiance doesn't read Stephen King. So, you know, all this information that I've collected about, you know, what day this happens and these two characters that cross paths and go on to have their own stories, It's just, where else am I going to put it?
Yeah, you got to put it in the world somewhere.
Yeah. And as you know, I don't have time for my podcast anymore. But maybe one day we'll have a Stephen King podcast of our own.
Ooh, that'd be fun. Okay, so tell us, because you've been working on a lot of like art projects and stuff. So tell us what you can about that.
Yeah, so I think the last time I was on, these books weren't out yet, but Enter Softly by Tyler Jones is a collection of three novellas, and I did the front and back cover for it and interior illustrations.
But they're gorgeous.
Thank you. He's such a good guy. He hired me initially to illustrate his short story collection, but then he just kept having all these projects pop up and he wanted me to contribute to them. And we've become really good friends over this whole experience. This is the first time I've ever had illustration experience. So I'm still working on the short story collection that comes out in February next year. And I'm just dying to share the work from it because I'm so proud of it. Okay, so if you're listening to this on Thursday, the day it comes out, he's doing the cover reveal for Burn the Plans, the short story collection, tomorrow on Friday. I did not design the cover for it, but I'm still excited because I've read the whole book and it's really good. And I'm still working on the art for that. And then also, I recently started working on the StokerCon 2022 souvenir book. And as far as I know, I don't have a lot of info yet, but as far as I know, this is a book that you can only get if you attend StokerCon. It's going to be the first time in 2 years that they're having it in person again because COVID.
That's awesome. And
it is a book that is going to be, from what I've been told, it's kind of like a compilation of interviews and essays and maybe some fiction by winners and nominees of the Bram Stoker Award by the Horror Writers Association. So I was kind of brought in to do some really cool gothic castle type illustrations to just kind of break up the text. The theme is just kind of like getting together and coming home into a spooky world that everyone loves. So awesome. That's really fun. And there's a lot more stuff that I can't say yet, but I will soon if you follow me on Twitter, RyanM642.
I was just going to say, where can we follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, so that's RyanM642. Also follow Tyler Jones because he will be dropping a lot of info as well. I'm working on getting a website up for the first time, but I'm not going to say it because I don't know when that's going to be ready yet.
Okay. So the Facebook group for the Castle Rock Book Club, if anybody wants to join, is just Castle Rock Club?
Yeah, I don't know what all will pop up if you search that. So if I were you and you really want to get in on this Castle Rock Club, which you definitely want to, just get in touch with me directly at RyanM642 on Twitter, or just get in touch with Sherry through Scaredy Cats Podcast directly, because we're both in it and we can both give you that link.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on today to talk about Stephen King and in general, but Castle Rock books specifically. I know it's something a little different than we usually do. In fact, it's something very different. We've never had an episode just about books. So it's exciting.
So fun. I really needed this. I really need that outlet.
It was fun. And Ryan and I have been talking about different things that we can talk about. Like, so we might do an episode on horror shorts, which I'm pretty excited about because we spent last night watching some horror shorts and dying. And, yeah, so we'll probably do some more episodes on books soon because this was a lot of fun. So,
yay.
Yeah. So you can catch us on Twitter at CatScaredy and on Instagram at ScaredyCats the podcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts. And don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.